Hey, it's Alan, and I just wanted to let you know that you can now listen to the ongoing history of New Music early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The problem with so many interviews is that they come across as interrogations. I have a list of questions I must get through in the allotted time, so let us begin. Depending on the circumstances, that's sometimes the route you have to take. But there's nothing more human than sitting down for a simple chat. If you can get some people in a room and just get them talking, then everyone forgets that they're being interviewed for something and the answers just flow. They get into a groove and start remembering things and telling stories that aren't included in any official bios or Wikipedia entries. This is the whole purpose of these occasional episodes I call In Their Own Words. Not only do we learn about the artist, but we get to see them as proper human beings. We get to really know them in ways we otherwise might not. And that's fantastic. I had a chance to chat with Ian Thornley. He is one of Canada's great guitar players. He's a great session guy, great performer. Let's hear more of what he had to say. This is Ian Thornley, in his own words, part two.
This is the Ongoing History of New Music podcast with Alan Cross.
Ian Thornley and the first version of Big Wreck, that's Ladylike, from the second album, The Pleasure and the Greed, released in the summer of 2001. Hi there, I'm Alan Cross, and this is part two of my In Their Own Words talk with Ian. The first half went really deep into the early years of his career and those first two Big Wreck albums. But that first version of the band was done by 2002. Why? Well, let's pick up the conversation. So when does that band end?
Probably 01, 02, somewhere in there.
What did you do after that?
Just kept writing. Just did the Thornley thing, you know?
But that wasn't... When did that actually...
03, 04.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I got married in there. I moved back to Toronto and had gotten married and had a writing room in Toronto. That's where I met Sekou, and then the whole Thornley thing had started.
Well, you had the first Thornley record, which is Come Again... 2004, mm-hmm. And then there's a 5-year break before Tiny Pictures comes out. What were you doing during that 5-year break?
Whatever I could.
Which means what? You know, you're a professional.
Taking gigs whenever I can get them. Taking a run, taking a tour whenever I can get it. Doing whatever I can. There's some people within that deal that I have a lot of love for and that I consider family. And there are some people that I absolutely hate that are just bad people. You know, I'm not going to mention any names, but not that anybody would even know who I'm talking about.
Now, are we talking about the band Thornley period?
Yeah, there are some, and that's, again, that's one of the things that you learn along the way. It's like, oh, I get it.
Well, were people trying to take advantage of you?
Oh,
were
big they... time. And I actually remember a phone conversation where I was, I'm not pointing fingers, but there was a phone conversation that was had where it just really dawned on me. And I remember it like it was yesterday, and this had to be 05, 06, when it was like, well, why aren't you doing this? Because if it's this simple move and you make this call, then we get this money and I can make this record and then we can go do this. And the U.S. wants us to do this. Why won't you do that? Like, this is my child. I need to pay for her clothes here, man. And the quote was, I don't give a fuck about your child. And it was like, wow, that's from.
Okay.
Yeah, and this is by no means someone that I thought was a friend. This is somebody who I was in business with, and I was Wow, that's amazing.
These are the things that a lot of music fans don't ever hear about. It's the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. They think that, you know, first of all, they think the music is a meritocracy, and if it's good, it'll rise to the top.
Yeah, that's not necessarily true.
And then there's, you know, what happens when you don't have an album cycle happening or you're on the road. You have to deal with, you know, to quote Joni Mitchell, the star-making machinery behind the popular song.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is like, you know, I mentioned Nickelback, and I'm like, I shouldn't lump him in with, like Chad, I think, is really quite brilliant at what he does. And like I said before, it's just not what I do. But having said that, and I've worked a lot with the guy, and he's a family member to me. He's a very close guy and very close friend. But the way that he works is very different than the way that I work. And when you have that kind of success working one way, that's the way that you do it. And there's people that are around something like that, a hit like that or a success like that. There are a lot of people that are around it. And that's, you know, some of those people who will follow that and that's the way to do it. And then you're not doing it that way. And it's like, wait a minute, man. Because that's not coming from Chad. It's coming from other people.
Now, what I'm finding interesting is that this is your child, your baby.
Yeah.
And the conviction that you have in protecting your baby is not something that you see in a lot of musicians. Because it's not that they're sellouts. It's not that they're, subject to all kinds of, you know, manipulation. It's that, okay, if I want to make a living, yeah, I'm going to have to do this. But, you know, that didn't matter.
Well, even with all this coronavirus stuff going on, I'm like, man, it's going to happen. Like this summer, I'm going to have to get a job at Long McQuaid. It's coming. It's coming. I still think like that, you know. I have a 11-month-old at home that, you know, he eats a lot of food, man. He eats more than I do. And they're constantly there. These worries are constantly there. And even before I had kids, there was always I'm not doing enough, I'm not measuring up, that kind of thing. But definitely there's a self-motivating mechanism in there that's not necessarily has to do with the art of it. It has to do with like, well, man, this is...
Well, practicalities.
This could, yeah, it's like the spinning a plate. It's like this could go at any time. It's not like you're getting into the corporate world and just sort of following a path.
After Big Rec version 1.0 broke up, Ian moved back to Toronto, where he found work as a session player. If you look in the liner notes for albums by Nickelback and Sarah Harmer and Stephen Fearing, you'll see his name. His relationship with Chad Kruger of Nickelback led him to signing with 604 Records out of Vancouver. And this was the beginning of a brand new band simply called Thornley, with a brand new lineup, with the exception of Brian Doherty on guitar, who was a holdover from Big Rec. The debut from this new group was called Come Again, and it was released on May 11th, 2004. The title track was a huge single on Canadian radio, too. Ian Thornley working in his post-Big Rec band Thornley from 2004. That debut album, Come Again, earned 2 Juno nominations and at least 4 singles made it to radio. There were more tours and a second album was scheduled for release, but then a very weird opportunity came up. Ian was offered the chance to be the singer and frontman of a new American supergroup. We'll get him to tell that story next. This is part 2 of an In Their Own Words program with Ian Thornley. Just as his solo band was gaining momentum, he got a phone call. And it's not the kind of phone call you would expect.
You had an opportunity to make bank in a really big way.
Yeah. I don't know how big it would have been.
Well,
it's certainly more than, yeah.
Okay, so let's set this up. Scott Weiland is the singer of Velvet Revolver.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Weiland is either fired from or quits Velvet Revolver. The other guys in the band want to keep Velvet Revolver happening because at this point, the idea of Guns N' Roses getting back together is completely out of the question.
Yeah.
So they went through a very long period of time, which is still going on, apparently.
Really?
Why, they got a new singer? looking for a guy to replace Scott Weiland. And somehow, your name came up. So let's go through that story, because I find this is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, they did twice. The first time, I think it was through management and stuff like that, or label or something. But I remember getting a CD right before the first Thornley record came out. I got a CD with three cuts on it, just instrumental tracks. And I was like, wow, this Thornley record's about to drop. So, you know, I didn't pay too much attention to it. And I'm like, I'm sure they're going to get somebody, you know. And then they got Weiland.
Right. So you were considered?
I guess so. Because I do remember getting a CD with like three sort of bed tracks, riffs and bass and guitars.
Before Weiland signed up.
Before Weiland. And I was like, they're going to get somebody that, you know. And then I heard that it was Scott, and I was like, oh, that's going to be great. Of course. What a front guy, you know.
Oh, no kidding.
That's what you need. Like, that guy's, you can't take your eyes off him. And then, yeah, when it came around again, I was...
Which would have been after the second album and that blow up in Scotland.
Yeah, it was sort of in you know, and when you were like, what did you do in those years? And I think I had just finished. I was in Nashville, doing the finishing touches on the second Thornley record with Nick and Scott Gorman. The drummer from Black Crowes, great drummer. I was there and then got the call from. We'd gotten the call a week earlier, and it was like, okay, I'd sent down the demo. Like, they'd send the phone call came from Slash. I was driving back from a gig or something.
Oh, and the phone rings, and it's Slash.
Yeah, and then the wife was like, I got a call from Slash. I was like, what? Cool. I got home and I called him up, and he was like, well, yeah, let me send you some stuff, and then, okay, it was something.
How do you suppose they heard about you?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean,
because if you're Slash and Duff,
when they knew a lot. Like, Duff knew all kinds of, like, he knew about Berkeley, and I was like, wow, man, like, these guys are. But I guess I was surprised when I left there. I mean, the end of the story is that it didn't really work, because like they wanted like a, you know, David Lee Roth, Scott Weiland, you know, a peacock. And I'm like, I need a guitar to, you know.
Yeah, but we got a guy in a top hat that's playing guitar for us, so.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, I'm not going to, it wouldn't have worked. I mean, musically it worked, vibe-wise it worked, the chemistry, everything was there. It was all great.
But it wouldn't have been
the package that they're, you know.
So did you must have gone down to L.A. to rehearse and...
Yeah, we just went into, you know, whatever, you know, Slash had full touring rig going. It was great, man. It was like, wow, you had three full stacks on. I was like, to rehearse? Yes, dude. And he was chain puffing, and it was like this is awesome. These guys are for real. And they were all really, really sweet and articulate and cool and down to earth. And it was just like, well, it's just like any of us, just like any band of guys. It's like we all kind of fall into certain roles. And this was no different. You know, they were no different. It was really nice to see that. It wasn't the reality show, whatever, that I had imagined it would be like. They were just like real dudes. They were real normal guys, like any other band that I'd toured with before.
Because you have your child, mm-hmm. your baby, and you were used to calling the shots and playing guitar. You just decided that it wasn't.
I don't think calling the shots would really have anything to do with it. I wouldn't go into that saying, dude, we're going to do some of my songs. You know, Slash, why don't you let me take the solo on this one? I wasn't anything like that. It was just like, I don't mind. I'll do the gig. I'm not that comfortable doing the whole, you know, front guy tambourine thing. It's just not for me. Oddly enough, like Miles, who sings with Slash all the time, Miles and I go way back, and we suffer from the same affliction. We're guitar players first and singers second.
And this is Miles Kennedy.
Miles Kennedy. But you know, he got over it, obviously, because he does that now all the time. Like, he's Mr. He doesn't need to have the guitar in his hands. Like, he'll do the, you know, pointing the mic at the audience, all the moves, you know, those sort of
I don't see
are
it.
They are
I
they shtick? Sure, but they're not for me, man. I don't.
I just don't see you doing it. No. No offense.
And you know, if you can get away with it, why not?
Just in case you don't remember Velvet Revolver, here's a sample. The first album was self-titled, and this is Slither. It's a crazy story about Ian Thornley and Velvet Revolver, right? Just one of those great what-if situations. Next up in all this is the Tiny Pictures album. This was the second album released under the name Thornley and came out 5 years after the first one, February 2009. Most of the material on this record had been around for years, but with so much else going on, including touring with Nickelback, Three Days Grace, and Lenny Kravitz, there just wasn't any time. Pretty much every part of this album was played by Ian himself, although there were a few songwriting collaborations. This song, for example, was co-written with David Genn, who would work with both Matt Good and 5440. It's called Make Believe. So this is what it feels like running through my lines. I'm never gonna pretend that I find it's just a waste of time. This is what it feels like when the hero dies. To the next one, funny how time flies. Make Believe from the second Thornley album, Tiny Pictures. But that was also the last Thornley record. Let's get back to my talk with Ian.
So there were a couple of Thornley records. There was Come Again, Tiny Pictures in 2009. Somewhere around in there, we have the Velvet Revolver experience.
Yeah.
And then we end up with Big Wreck version 2.0. Mm-hmm. I remember having a discussion with somebody somewhere around 2010, 2011, about Canadian bands that we wish could get back together because they didn't completely fulfill their potential because they weren't around long enough. And I think I Mother Earth came up. I think Lowest of the Low came up. And Big Wreck certainly did come up.
Cool.
And then all of a sudden, there's Big Wreck version 2.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, we were doing a Thornley tour. And Brian and I had sort of reconnected. Brian was initially going to be the other guitar player in Thornley. And then the sort of, let's call it the grown-ups, the people on the other side of the desk were like, it's too much like Big Wreck if Brian's around. And I was like, oh, shit, you know. All right.
So the idea was to make Thornley a separate sort of thing from Big Wreck.
Very different. So anyway, and I'm sure as you can imagine that probably added some strain to the relationship, among you know all the other ones of the whole whatever was left of Big Wreck after it. So yeah, we'd sort of you know maybe on around Christmas we'd touch base you know once a year or whatever. But we sort of, you know, I remember just kind of calling him up out of the blue because I'd missed him and I was, you know, I just missed that sort of connection and without even, you know.
Was he living in New York still?
Nope. He had married a Canadian girl in Sarnia. So he's living in Sarnia. And then we were playing a Thornley show down near Sarnia, and I was like, "Well, why don't you come out to the show and we'll say hey." So he came out to the show, and we hung out, and it was really great. You know, it was a good vibe. And then I think it was at that show, Paulo, who was the guitar player in Thornley at the time, Paulo was like, "Oh, by the way, that gig in Edmonton, I'm not going to be there, as I'm going on my honeymoon in Portugal with." And I was like, oh, okay.
Do I know any guitar players?
Yeah, and it was literally one of those. Brian was right there. I was like, Brian, you want to come play a Thornley show? We can just throw like more Big Wreck numbers in if you want. He was like, sure. And that was it. We did the gig, and Jeff Burrows from the Tea Party was actually our drummer at the time.
I remember that. Yeah.
We did, I don't know how many shows, but we did a few shows with JB. So we went out and did the gig in Edmonton. And that was it was weird, as I remember looking over and I was like, "This feels normal." It didn't. I was like, "This is gonna feel really weird because I'm so used to Paulo being there. You know, Paulo's doing his thing." And then I look over and it's not Paulo; it's Brian doing his thing. I was like, "Yeah, like it was almost like he'd never left."
Well, that was a 10-year gap.
Yeah, it was very weird, but not weird. It's hard to explain. But so anyway, the idea from that show, the idea to like, what if we did a tour where we do a set of Thornley stuff, and then we bring Brian out, we do a set of Big Rec stuff. Right. And then while we were in rehearsals to do that, we just kind of kept doing things as a five piece. So that we did that tour with the same five people on stage for both sets, and it was awesome. And I was like, dude, I all flushing out all those guitar parts at once live, two great guitar players sort of flanking me like that, was just, the sound was huge. And then that was, you know, we went in to go do a record, and we were essentially going in to do a Thornley record. But we were now with SRO Anthem, and, you know, Ray and Andy were basically like...
This is Rush's management company.
Yeah, and they were like, well, now that we got you away from those people, do what you want. Go do what you want to do. We're not going to say, it has to be like this. It has to be like that. A hit sounds like, you know.
Yeah.
They were like, no. Go do you. Go do art. Go do music. Let's see how far you can push it. So I just kind of went in and did whatever we do. And we got Eric Ratz to you know, man the board. And he knows how to get the sounds that I like to hear. And he knows how to do it beautifully. So we just kind of did something very easy, natural. It was a very easy thing to make. And then somebody came up with the idea. It might have been Nick Raskulinix, who's the executive producer, I guess we'll call him. He was like, man, you should call it a Big Rec record, man. I was like, well, it's only Brian and I are the original guys.
Doesn't matter.
Like, whatever, man, you're singing. That's my really bad in Knoxville, Tennessee. But then somebody put a sticker on the track sheet, a Big Rec sticker on the track sheet, and it was like... You know, the more you sat with it, it was like, I mean, it kind of has that sound. It sounds like the first record, like the demos that we made when there weren't any suits in the room saying, well, that actually, the statistics say that a hit should essentially, you should hit the chorus before, you know, all that shit. It was just like, we're just making music here. And, you know, just to be back to doing that, that's the sound you get.
We get to the Albatross album, and the Albatross is an unlucky bird.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you call an album after an unlucky bird?
Dude, I just named the album after the song. Like, I know about the whole Coleridge thing and all that, but and honestly, like, as I was writing the song Albatross, the word just fell into my lap, and I was like, I'll wear the albatross for one more day. I was like, okay.
I can't help thinking about John Cleese walking through the Hollywood Bowl. Albatross!
Yeah. I never really... consider any of that stuff. I'm just sort of, and when it comes to naming an album, like, generally we just pick a title off of one of the songs, except for In Loving Memory and But for the Sun. I think those are the only two that where we didn't do that.
The music industry of Big Rec version 1.0 was very different from what you had to deal with Big Rec version 2.0.
I mean, being Wine and Dine by Ahmet Erdogan has its ups. That was
back
awesome.
In the day, yeah.
That was great.
Yeah.
But not having to worry about...
Did you actually go out for dinner with Ahmet Erdogan?
Yeah. I mean, I was brought up to his office by Craig Kalman.
Wow.
And they were like, you know, Ahmet was sitting there and they were playing him the tunes. He's like, who's a guitar player? And they were like, he is. He's like, I thought you were the singer. And he's like, he is too. That's him, the same guy. He was like, great guitar player. He's like, thanks, man. And then he's like, and then he's just kind of sitting there. And Craig's like, why don't you tell him the Stone story? Give him the Stone story. He's like, which one? And then he told me the great story about when, you know, they were in the south of France and there was bowls of cocaine going around and the chief of police in the little town where they were all staying comes to the party that they're at, and he's like, what's that? And then they start taking it all and putting it on their face like it's like they're just like the, like they were doing
like it's stuff. Powder makeup.
Yeah, they're like, no, it's just I was like, wow. And then he gave me some Zeppelin stories, and you know, and he'd come to a couple shows, like when we were in New York, he'd come out. He always have like 6 foot bookend model gals with him on either arm. He was a little guy.
Little Turkish guy.
Little guy. Bald, but finely manicured mustache and goatee all the time perfectly. And he always had these giant Amazonian gorgeous women with him who are, you know, the rest of the band, all the band guys are like, dude, you know, it's one of those. But yeah, no, that was great. This is something else. This is just like, you know, all that, we got to ride in a limo, all that. It's just like, you know, that's when you're 20, it's fine.
Yeah.
Now I just want to make music that counts, you know.
Give me your favorite Big Wreck or Thornley recorded performance. What song can you go back to again and again and again and say, you know what, I did
that
good.
That was nice. I couldn't really pick just one. Like each record, I think, has special moments for different reasons. It's usually the songs that just kind of fall in your lap, and then you're just like, can I get away? Like Wolves on the Albatross record. I still, if I go and listen to that, I'll probably get disinterested. But if it comes on the radio, I'm like, God damn, that was a... And it was just one of those, just pop, put the guitar in a particular tuning. I think I was on the phone at the time, and my fingers just kind of found a shape, and I was like, and then the song kind of falls into your lap, and I'm like, this is a pretty simple, straightforward, like down the middle of the road song for us. But I'm like, but vocal range wise, it's sort of up near the top, like it's up in the higher register, and just there's something sort of bittersweet and that sort of lilting. I like that one. Place to Call Home off a Ghost record. I think there's a few on the last record. I think Alibi is, you know, Alibi gets me. You know, it's hard. I could never just pick one.
Let's hear one of those songs. This is Wolves from the Albatross album. Version 2 of Big Wreck with Wolves, another single from the Albatross album from March of 2011. Not really a comeback record, but more of a reboot. When we come back, we'll go through what's happening with Big Wreck since then, and we'll wrap up the conversation with Ian's road story that, well, you'll see. This is the home stretch of an In His Own Words program with Ian Thornley. The second version of Big Wreck has stuck around for more than a decade, and there have been some fantastic successes. The Albatross album was nominated for a Juno. It was followed by Ghosts in 2014, and it too was nominated for a Juno. There was a detour back to the Thornley approach in 2015 when Ian recorded a solo album entitled Secrets, and then it was back to Big Wreck for the Grace Street album in 2017, after which came But for the Sun in 2019. Each album saw a lot of touring, and not all of them went off so well. Can you think of a road story that you will be able to tell your children and grandchildren somewhere down the line?
Children?
Okay, maybe not.
I mean, there are so many.
Okay, you're going to write an autobiography. I don't know. If you're going to write an autobiography...
What kind of story you want? Think about it. You're talking 23 years of...
I know.
That's a lot of stories, dude. That's a long time to be on the road.
It is, but one that if you were to write your autobiography, this would be the one that gets an excerpt.
There you go. We're doing a Thornley tour. And I think we were in Edmonton, Calgary or Edmonton, and we had a film crew with us. It was a group of students from Ryerson, sweet kids, all of them. Mike Alfano, he's like president of Apple Canada now. He's a hotshot. He's great, great guy, and is a friend to this day. He was sort of in charge of this. They were in an RV that followed the bus from show to show. But anyway, that's an aside. There was a group of cameras on the stage, and this is back in the day. Everything was tuned really low, and I was running a lot of amps, so we'd blow the power a lot, and we were loud, so the power kept going out. I think it was a Halloween show, I want to say. But anyway, power kept going out, and so I'm trying to keep the audience engaged. There's still a couple lights on the stage. I'm trying to keep the audience engaged.
While they reset the breakers.
Yeah. So I'm jumping around and sort of waving my arms and like jumping off the drum riser, whatever. Just like anything to sort of, you know, let's whoop it up. Row, row, row your boat, whatever you can. We just start the song again. Boom, something else pops. So I'm doing whatever, being a clown, trying to keep the audience with us. And during one of these jumps, my pants split open. In the crotchal area. In these days, I didn't wear underwear. This is real. So out pops, I don't know how much of what, because I didn't see the footage, but it's on camera. But I was just like, oh my God,
Yeah.
It was like 5,000 people just saw my balls. So here's the best part is, what are we going to do now? Because I'm like, they're split. It's maybe a 4 or 5, 6 inch split right there.
Yeah.
And I can't finish the performance without, being arrested. So Timmy, who was on tour with us, is like my second dad. He's already on his way to the bus. He's sprinting to the bus to go and grab another pair of pants. I'm off to stage right. I'm off the side of the stage, and there's like a group of people around me, sort of shoulder to shoulder, making this sort of barricade. While Shane, who's my guitar tech, pulls out the gaffer tape and proceeds to start gaffer taping my. And I was like, dude, don't, no. Like, you're not putting duct tape down there. So that's it. And then, maybe, I don't know how much duct tape actually got on, and then Timmy finally showed up with another pair of pants. So I just kind of dropped trowel, put those back on, and then I made it, power was back, we finished the show. But there's a story for it. Yeah, there's video somewhere of, I don't know how much was revealed, because when I landed from this jump, I remember like that felt, oh no. So yeah, I know at the very least the brain popped out, like my balls came out. I know that much. I don't know how much of anything else was revealed.
My thanks to Ian Thornley and his management team for making it possible for Ian to come in for this In His Own Words session, and I hope he got some insight into Ian. Also his work and maybe how the music industry operates. We heard a lot about stuff that we don't normally see. Podcasts for ongoing history shows are available anywhere. If it serves up podcasts, it will include ongoing history shows. Download it will. And if you can, please rate and recommend. If you have a moment, check out my website, which is ajournalofmusicalthings.com. This is where you can go to get ready-made playlists for each episode. And you should also get the free daily newsletter. That way you'll never miss a story or a notification. What else? Okay, I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and every email sent to alan@alancross.ca will be processed. Thanks to Adam for help engineering the interview. All other technical productions by Rob Johnston. Talk to you next time. I'm Alan Cross.
You've been listening to the Ongoing History of New Music podcast with Alan Cross. Subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and everywhere you find your favorite podcasts.